You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCRLP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.
Hi, I'm Andrew Miller, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Andrew Miller. He's the author of Namaste, Mark Confidential. Andrew, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. Like I was just saying before we started recording, this is the very first thing I'm doing for my very first novel. I've had quite a few short stories. I had one novella, but
right.
It's never been just me doing something with just my name on it. Obviously, there's like a whole team at Run Amok that got me here, but this is a big deal for me. I'm pretty pumped.
I'm pumped too. How did you connect with Run Amok? Who are they?
Basically, I wrote a short story. Like when I'm always writing. I've always got something going. As soon as I'm done with something, I immediately start with something else. And I had a short story called Samurai 81. Usually, when I write something, I kind of think like maybe I could send it to this guy, or maybe I could send it to this guy. At least they'll hear me out. This was one that it was just like completely just fun and outrageous and ridiculous to me. It was basically, it's a detective story. I usually do detectives, hard-boiled crime, noir, that sort of thing, about a young Japanese-American LAPD detective that comes to realize that every single member of the LAPD who is Japanese-American in the 80s, so everybody's got, you know, mullets and stuff. They are all members of a secret society of 1980s samurai. And so I wrote that. I had no idea if anyone would like it. And I sent it blind to Vern Smith at Run Amok Crime. I didn't know him. And he was very supportive. He really liked it. And it came out in an anthology called, Jacked. It came out in 2022. It won this award. And what Vern kind of told me was that Gary Anderson, the managing editor of Run Amok, he was kind of looking for people in doing this anthology that might have a bigger project. And they asked me if I had anything. And this was just something that I was working on. I didn't know if I would actually find a home for it, but I sent it to them. They liked it. And all this time later, here I am.
Isn't it lovely? I mean, when we don't know where our writing's going to go. And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh wait, it goes somewhere. And we're like demented for thinking that our writing will go anywhere. You know, you're just like, this isn't going to go any. I mean, for me, I'm always like, nothing's going to come of this. And then I work on it for 2 years and it's just like, still nothing comes of it. Nothing. But you're ready when the something's there. And then all of a sudden someone goes, yeah. And so people think, oh, that's luck. But it's just like, no, it's the daily grind, man. And then sometimes luck just, you know, it's not luck. It's kind of a luck of the draw. But at the same time, you know, there's people out there that we're working our asses off every day. Because we have to, because we're insane. Because we need other income to, you know, it's just almost like it would be better to be a habitual, you know, computer coder than, you know, financially. But for the soul points, man, about the writing. It's like why when I see you, I'm just like, it's a breath of fresh air, because it's just like, oh, hola, comrade. And it's just like, we got the secret handshake, which is just a sigh of like, oh dear God. And then, I noticed you, you dedicated the book to Melly Corrado, and she's the one from, is she the one from Trader Joe's who was.
There's some stuff in there that I kind of don't want to get in too much detail, but Melly Corrado,
what did I just say?
Melly Corrado was a manager of Trader Joe's who I knew, who was shot and killed in a gunfight on July 21st, 2018.
Brutal. And
there's just been a lot of stuff. It's sort of a lot of things that kind of happened. I mean, there's the pandemic, there was that, and there were a lot of things that happened to me that usually it's like when people say that they write something personal, that story that I mentioned to you earlier, I sort of see that story as personal. I mean, I'm not a Japanese American LAPD detective living in 1981, but I personally thought it was really interesting. I don't usually write about myself. This book is fiction. It's completely fiction, but there's a greater degree of me in it. My personality, the narrator, a lot of people have picked up on, is obviously supposed to be me. I mean, there are scenes where this guy is, you know, he's got a machine gun and he's, you know, gunning down, paramilitary Mormon gangsters. So, I mean,
which you always do. Yeah.
I obviously haven't done a great deal of things that happen in the book, but it was just sort of, everything is very heavily plotted. Hopefully it's a very entertaining book. I recently got some very nice messages from our mutual friend, Gabe Hart.
Oh, cool. Did he read it?
Yeah. He just was saying how funny it is. And yeah, that's very nice to hear, because I think it's a very funny story, but there are a lot of very, personal things that were driving me to write the story. It's not a Romana Clef. It's not an example of me writing things that actually happen, but it's definitely a very, very heartfelt and comes from a lot of pain that I've gone through in the past few years.
Do you feel like that this is kind of the first time you've really kind of opened yourself up into a story? And is that something that you find that you're doing now, where there's a little more like the stuff you're working on now? Is it also kind of your heart's kind of getting more and more into your work in that way?
I mean, it's kind of like in one project, it might be that way. Mm-hmm. And then in another project, it's just me having fun, but it still is personal to me because I really like it. I really like whatever I'm doing and I really feel it. I guess if I don't feel it personally, then I don't write it. It's just not always a character that people could say like, oh, that's similar to me, you know? Whereas this one, obviously, there's a lot that people will find similar, for sure.
If they know you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Which a lot of people don't, of course. Yeah. Like the woman on the cover is supposed to be, it's a reference to, I don't know if I should mention her name while we're recording, but it's a very well-known, you know, West Hollywood personality that some people get who that's supposed to be and some people don't. It's like, it's some people are sort of, Angelinos are tending to get more of the jokes than the people outside of LA, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I would, I think I've parked next to her car once and I should have taken a photo. I was so bummed. I was like, I'll come back and take a photo later. And then all of a sudden, and this was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I finally, you know, I first moved to LA, I didn't know who she was. And I'm just like sitting there going, oh, that's a shame. You know, when I see a personalized license plate in a car, I usually go, it's personalized license plates. I don't get those, especially like on any car for the most part. It's like even the luxury cars, it's just I just look at them and I'm like, why are you making yourself a target? It's like, I don't even put stickers on my car in LA because I don't want to be a target. I don't want somebody to go,
yeah.
You know, and it's just such a, that's why I don't wear my San Francisco Giants baseball cap around town, because that's a huge target. That's like,
for sure.
That's like, hi, kick my ass.
you're kind of a rebel and you're sort of being contrary in LA if you're just walking around not trying to get attention sometimes.
Right. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Exactly. Don't look at me. I was. That's when you. A minute ago, you were talking about plotting, and you're heavily plot. When you're writing, do you? What's first? Are you looking at plot? Are you looking at character? Does the character come first, and then you plot? Are you an outliner?
I'm very much an outliner.
Okay.
Yeah, very much an outliner. It can depend on the project. Usually the most important thing is just knowing the ending. I heard from a great writer named Matt Witten, who he's pretty knowledgeable about PI novels, and he said it's on the blurb in the book that he had never it was one of the coolest endings of a PI novel he ever had read. And so if there's a plot, I definitely need to know the ending. And then in some cases, the characters might come from the plot. But in this particular instance, it's too unlicensed detectives in Los Angeles in 2013. And the personality of one of the detectives is me. And then the other guy is a guy who is one of my good friends, who I think I've told you about this guy before, who has lived enough life to have multiple books written about his various adventures. And so
do you guys work together?
We used to.
Oh, okay. Because there's a guy, not to interrupt you, but I was at Trader Joe's yesterday when it was a little cold out, you know? Mm-hmm. Cold Los Angeles style, not cold like Philadelphia. I apologize, Philadelphia. When it's 59 degrees, it's a problem. So I had my scarf and my hat on, and I was walking through the line, and I think you've talked about this guy before, and I think he's Korean, and he looks at me and he goes, "Are you a writer?" I'm like, I teach more than I write, but yeah, because you know, that's what and when I say that, I mean, like, people go, "What's your occupation?" And I write, and like, you know, maybe a little money streams in, but actually a paycheck comes from teaching. Yeah, but for sure. And he goes, "Oh, okay, cool, because we got a guy here, Andy." And I'm like, "Yeah, I know." What are you talking about? I know, he's coming on my podcast this week. And there's been a couple times at Trader Joe's where people are just kind of like, they'll, you know, like, cause I love to talk to the cashiers, and just like, when they're like, "How you doing?" I'm like, "You know what? It's a weird day, man." And then all of a sudden we have like this, they slow down the scanning, cause then we have a real conversation, you know? And it's, I always feel like I walk away with just like, oh, because we're both kind of disgruntled anyway, but everyone's always very proud of you. And I love that.
Yeah, for sure. A part of, you know, again, I don't want to get too close into my actual job, but I've had a lot of jobs like the characters in this book. And one of the things that you see is, you know, everybody has to buy groceries. And that's kind of one element of a detective story that I hadn't really thought of before, that there have been, you know, you see anybody in LA, if you're in a grocery store, you might run into all sorts of different people. And so
I saw David J at Albertson's in Los Feliz, from Bauhaus and Eleven Rockets. He's the bass player. I saw him like 3 days ago. And like, when you try to jockey for a position, cause you're like, "Oh my God, he's getting close." Cause I want to say hi to him. And he's getting like closer to the front on his line, and my catcher's going too slow. And then it's just like, and then he was out, and I'm like, "Oh, David J missed opportunity." Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. But yeah, that was definitely an element I wanted to explore, where, you know, it's all fiction, but you know, the detectives will see a suspect that they've got a little, you know, they've got some suspicions, you know, see him in the frozen aisle. Whereas in a normal detective novel, there would be no reason for the detective to be there, but these guys have to maintain their jobs at a Hindu themed grocery store called Namaste Mart,
which I love,
which also, you know, something that we've kind of chatted about from time to time, that, you know, I think a place like Namaste Mart, you know, might have existed in 2013, but it wouldn't have existed in 2024. It would have been perceived as insensitive. It would have been perceived as, you know, people were trying to get points, dunking on it on social media. And something that people have told me about the book, that I've kind of heard a few comments from early readers about how it feels so different. And one of the things, it's not a screed. I'm not trying to make any type of political point, but in setting it in 2013, I just really wanted to just convey I don't think people understand how much has changed in the past decade. My friend, the writer, Alex Cizek, he had a prompt for his magazine, Pulp Modern, where you had to do, it came out in an issue that came out in 2021, and it had to have stories that were set in 2011. And he said how there have been more changes in the 2010s than in any decade that he had been alive. And in having the book set then, it's just, you really get a sense of things have changed so much. And I really think that most of the changes have been for the worse, for a lot of reasons that are discussed and for a lot of reasons that aren't usually discussed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that today too. I'm doing my dopamine detox, which means I got to get off social media as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So I realized this the other day when I'm like, wait a second, how often am I looking at my screen? I got to stop this. It just come back to reality, man. And I'm the one that's disgusted going, look at all these people just looking down at their screens. And then I look down at my screen and then I'm like, I hate myself.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it's me. Maybe I'm upset about myself. So I, you know, push it on other people. Projection, I'm projecting. So,
I mean, it's that, but it's just, you know, I see, you know, younger kids where you get your update of how much time you spent each day. And for me, it gets depressing for me if I spent like an hour and a half, 2 hours or something. Yeah. Like, that's terrible. Where these kids, it's just like, it's like 5, 8, 10. Like, how could you even be on it that much? And how much it's connected to the way that they behave and how they don't understand that there actually was a world where, like, you didn't have this, where, like, you go to a movie and you're waiting for the movie to start and you don't take out your phone. You just kind of sit there and, you know, anticipate like when the previews are going to start. Like, there was actually a time where like the light from the phone was not something that you just had to like expect to be there. And something that drives me even more crazy, that I think it's so much worse even since the pandemic, like not the entirety of the last decade, as I was saying, but just between early 2020 and now, like when I go to a movie now, like you can't find a place where you know that someone's not just going to take out their phone and get on social media in the movie theater while the movie is playing. It's just, this is not where you're like, go outside, dude, don't do that.
Yeah. It's so arrogant. It's very arrogant.
Always think that they know that they're doing it though. Like, it's like a mouse being zapped to go like a different direction on the maze. Like, it's just they have no control. They don't even realize.
I feel like what we need is a little baton that has a little jolt of electricity that just like goes when we see someone do that. No, I remember in San Francisco, and this was probably like 15 years ago. There was a woman at the theater, and she would not stop texting. And it was the old days where your text pad was like you had to hit number 7 like 3 times in order to get the W, right?
Yeah.
And we just started throwing popcorn at her. And she's like, what are you doing? We're watching a movie. And she's and then she put it away. And it's just like, that's like normal human interaction. If you're going to be that disrespectful, we're throwing popcorn at you. Now that's assault.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's a long gone world.
Yeah. And I think as humans, we're supposed to like kind of do that. It's there's a need to keep checking each other. Social norms, and people have checked me in my social abnorms, and I'm like, and I always thank them. I'm like, oh man, you're right, you know, I was being the idiot in that situation. It's just like, I need to be adjusted, and we all need to be adjusted, but nobody's accepting adjustment anymore. Everything is ow, you hurt me, and they fall on the ground, and you're just like, huh, what I hurt your feelings. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. And then you put your boot in their face and then you're like, now that hurts, right? It's like, we all got, I don't know if you got beat up, but I got beat up a few times as a kid, and it sucks. And it's like, it feels like the worst day of your life. And at the same time, it kind of molds you into empathy where you're like, wow, I'm never going to do that to someone else. And what kind of person does that just to be a bully, you know? But it molds you in a different way.
It can have a genuine character building experience at the same time. I mean, I had a friend in middle school that was kind of a tough guy. And then he moved, and in high school, I was kind of getting picked on by some guys that were older and bigger than me. And I was used to basically riding off the reputation of my friend in middle school, but he had moved, and it was just me. And it was an ongoing thing. And I just remember telling my friend at lunchtime, like I said, I'm going to ignore it unless they touch me. And then I'm going to do something. And then one of them went up and they just kind of smacked me on the back of the head, and I didn't see who it was. It was three different guys. And so I just went for the biggest one and hit him right in the jaw, and he backed down, and we ended up becoming friends. We were all cool like later on. And it was just like they weren't expecting me to do that. And it's just, I don't wish that situation on anybody, but it was just, I was scared and I dealt with my fear, and it all kind of worked out in the end. Nobody got hurt seriously. It was, that was a long time ago, but that was something that I think, I'm kind of glad that it happened that way.
I think the male conflict is we're all puppies when we're kids. We're supposed to bite each other just enough to see what we can do, and it's just like, to take that away from kids right now, I think that leads to scarier stuff when they get older, because they haven't tested it. It's like, we got to test it. And the bully kind of sit there and pick on the, and then it turns around. And we even look at it in the animal kingdom. It's just like, they'll be like, oh, okay, now we know where we're at. I could still beat you up, in the bully's mind, but you stood up to me. So now, and it may sound, it may sound like a bad idea, but I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it's kind of a good idea, because then it's almost like male intimacy. Cause like women, it's just because you became friends. And there's people that I've gotten, even over the last decade, into kind of like verbal, like, stay far away from me. And just, we had some, where they like, lived in my building or whatever. And it's just like, and I'm like, no, dude, this does not work. And then we become friends.
Yeah.
There's just a point where it's just like, oh wow, we both stand up to each other. And then there's this huge respect. And then there's like, hey, how you doing? Hug. Yeah. That's why when I enjoy watching UFC, because those guys, they'll jaw at each other all week for fight week, right? And then after the fight, they're usually just hugging. And it's just it's more intimate than sex, what they just did. And it's just like,
you got to have respect for the person that's making it so difficult for you to win the fight. You got to have respect for the effort that they're putting into it, for sure.
Yeah. And it's, to bring it back to writing, it's kind of like we're fighting with ourselves all the time. And then when our friends put out books, it's just like, oh, and we just want to hug them. And it's just, and if you're a friend who's also had books out, it's just, you understand the waves of it, where when I had a book, my first book out, I thought I was going to have a parade down Market Street, and there was going to be, mayor was going to declare a Tony Duchesne Day. And it's just like, no, you just got a book out. No one looks at you differently. No one cares.
Yeah.
But, did I go on? I went far there. Yeah. But 2013, I don't know. Do you think Namaste, you say it better. So can you say it for me?
Namaste, Mark Confidential.
Namaste, Mark. Namaste, Mark.
Yeah. It's a fictional chain of Hindu grocery stores sending up the fashionable spirituality that you can so easily find in Los Angeles.
Find tattooed on every single person you ever see. Those tattoos scare me. I do online dating sometimes, and if somebody has the what's the Namaste tattoo, it's the symbol, I think.
Oh yeah, I think I know what you mean. I thought of it as like I know that that's what you say like at the end of a yoga session, and I
And
thought
I
that's what.
do. I like
Yeah.
I'm the guy that does that. But
Yeah,
I'm not getting a tattoo on my, it's
yeah. Yeah,
just like an
right.
online dating. If someone's got a tattoo of namaste on their neck, I'm just like, yeah, no.
It was just I felt like I wanted to create a, fictional grocery store chain, and I felt like it would be a popular one.
I think I would be in. I'd be totally in on that grocery store chain. I think you may have something there, and I think we may be post where everyone screamed about appropriation, which is kind of not to get it's even talking about it. People go like, "Oh God, well, you're gonna vote for Trump then?" It's just like they make these assumptions, and it's just like, no. You don't understand. Appropriation is mostly like we're just all together in this melting pot. We don't know what we're
Yeah.
doing. And if someone wears a shirt and it looks cool, I'm gonna go find out where that shirt is and buy it just because I want to look cool.
And it's also something that is so uniquely this country. There was it was like one nonsense social media controversy from a long time ago. Just some young high school girl posted a picture of her prom dress. She was in her prom dress or some type of big event, and it was Asian themed. It was just this beautiful Asian themed dress, and it became a controversy because someone said, my culture is not your prom dress, something like that, and everybody just destroyed this girl online. And then there was this effort to contact Asian people from the, I don't remember the country the dress had come from, but they thought it was pretty nice that this young girl in America was wearing it. Just it's they don't understand the ridiculous hysteria here, that it just like it permeates art way too much. It just really it's really kind of antithetical to any good art.
Well, and the beauty too. It takes the beauty of humanity. It's like zapping it. It's just like there's
Yeah.
what why create such a stir when there's actual problems in the world? And I think that's when
Absolutely.
people actually need some problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've been on the they were they when they played at school, they were on little spongy things when they were on the handlebars, and they didn't like get a broken leg.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, now it's just like you should have given them a broken leg when they were 8. It's just they might have a better sense of life.
It's a nice thing if someone from a different culture like enjoys something from a culture that's not their own. Like there's a lot of Latino characters in Namaste Mart Confidential, and the reason I did that is because when I moved to LA, I would be in situations where having come from Ohio, where I would like look around, and it would be the first time in my life where like everyone in this room is Latino and I'm the only white guy, and all of these people are just being so nice to me. And they would tell me, like, I didn't know like what I remember not knowing what menudo was, and they explained it to me, and it made an impact. And so in my books, I often go back to characters that were inspired by those positive moments, and it's all just based on the positive experience of learning something different. And I think that it tends to be that with most people that get called out on something like cultural appropriation. It's pretty stupid. It's like, a better word might be like cultural admiration. And, why would you not like the fact that someone is having a degree of admiration for a particular kind of culture?
Which I started taking Spanish lessons again. It's just because I'm kind of bent. I'm like, you know what? I gotta start. I in 2 years I really want to just be like totally conversational. And it's and I want to do it in French because I used to do French in the 90s and I lost a lot of it, but there's no one to practice with in LA. I'm not gonna go, "Hey, bonjour." They'll be like, "Que tal?" But my tutor, who's Colombian, because I'm learning Colombian Spanish, and I'm just learning about all these different dialects and how different they are throughout Latin America, which blew my mind. It's And so we were talking about que pasa the other day on my lesson, and he's like, that's a very United States and Mexico greeting. That's
Yeah.
that only happens there. If you say que pasa in any other country, that's asking for a fight. That's like, what's up?
Right. Yeah. It's like
And
saying, where are you from in LA?
oh yeah. Who are you affiliated with?
Yeah, where are you from, fool?
Yeah. And I'm just like, oh. I remember this is when my Jehovah's Witness stuff, like I'll use it to protect me sometimes because when they had the when every once in a while when I lived in the Mission District in San Francisco, you knew the Peewees were out to do their initiations, and so they would say like, who are you
The
with?
Peewees?
They call it the gang members that are trying to get up, and so they would go out and just like stab people or mug
What type
people.
of gang is this in the Mission District?
These were the Sureños and the
Okay.
Norteños.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
So, and this and it, I've been around brutal gunfire stuff in those days. This is a
Yeah.
different era, San
Yeah.
Francisco, and but at the same time, it's just like, oh wait, this is initiation time. So I'd have it in my head, and they would just go up to anyone, usually just a white person, and just be like, who are you affiliated with? And in my
Yeah.
head, I'd be like, Jehovah God, our Savior. Like, it's just like if I get because that's gonna throw them off because it's and then they'll be like, oh wait, or Jesus Christ, my Savior, or something. Even though I'm not affiliated with that, but if you're telling someone in a possible violent situation, that's gonna be like that'll give you enough time and them enough time to go, wait, that you just kind of threw me for a loop there because I was trying to get you, but I didn't get you because you're some Jesus freak, and it's just and then it's just like and I didn't get stabbed on the bus,
I have there was the guy that the other detective in my novel is based on. There's a lot of passages that are they're fictionally depicted but emotionally true, in the sense that my friend's just like a really brave guy. Like he's just sort of fearless. And during this time when we were just, we were just reckless. We were out, getting drunk and just being stupid all the time.
I miss those days, but I kind of don't either, you know?
Same here. They had their place and they make for some good stories, but I'm glad that they're long gone. But I would get to a point sometimes, if my friend wouldn't be around, where I would be in a situation where something scary would happen, and one of the early things that would actually occur to me, usually when I've had way too much to drink and I'm, thinking very illogically and stupidly, I wouldn't want my friend to be disappointed in me when I told him the story. That would come to mind. And I was at a bar with another friend, not the guy I'm talking about, when a clearly a Latino gentleman with a very low hat, a Dodgers cap, where I can't really see his face, just bumps into me, and he says, "Where are you from?" And for some reason, that's the what I just said. That's what came to my mind. I thought, I can't let my friend think I got all scared here. And I try to think of something, funny to say, or something like, kind of cool to say. And for those who, can't actually see me, I'm a Caucasian gentleman from Ohio with glasses.
Gorgeous. If for those of you who can't see him, he's gorgeous.
And I say, "I'm from Boyle Heights. Where are you from?"
That's such a terrible idea.
Obviously, yes. The guy pulls his hat up, and he's a friend of mine. He's a friend of mine that know, like, he I didn't realize it at first. It's a dark bar. He had his hat down, and it was all cool. And then the next day when I sobered up, I thought, wow, that was really stupid.
That's like it's such a bad idea.
That could have gone very differently.
We may not have been talking today if that wasn't your friend.
Anyway, wow. That was an example. Like, that's not in the book, but there are examples where the character that's sort of supposed to be me gets inspired to do things because of his much more courageous friend. And that's an example of, like, you know, the person, like, I was thinking back to all these, like, personal memories, like, wow, that was really absurd that I did.
Yeah. And it's sometimes I look back and go, you know, I just got a lot of extra credit because there's so many times that it should have just yeah. ended with the stupidity that I did.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know if I ever told you about the time that I used to San Francisco has a lot more, like, I was DJing, I was out all the time. There's, you know, I lived a very different life. I come to LA and all of a sudden I turn into this monk who just goes to cafes and writes, drinks. It doesn't bar hop anymore. I didn't even know how to bar hop in LA. Y'all drive, right? It's just like, it's nuts. But the bar was packed. The bartender who owned the place knew me because he knows my drink because I'm there all the time. It was right next door. You know, it was in the Tenderloin. So he just throws me my Jameson soda and I'm just like, all right, because that was my drink at the time. I think it's almost every San Franciscan's drink. When you hit your 30s, it turns into Jameson soda. It's no longer rum and coke, it's Jameson soda. Yeah. So I'm walking through this packed bar and this guy throws a shoe at me from upstairs.
Ooh.
And drops my drink. And I'm like, you over there. You know, these guys are like half my age and you know, they all look like they're in the football team. So
yeah,
we meet each other at the top of the stairs and I'm like, you're buying my next drink. And he's like, give me back my shoe. And I'm like, give me the money. And so he pulls his wallet out. And he's like, no, just give me back my shoe. And so I put my hand in his wallet and I pull out a handful of money. The next thing I know, I'm at the bottom of the stairs, splayed out. So he punched me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I went down the stairs. And then I was like, first things was, where's my glasses? Someone like helped me with my glasses.
Right. Yeah.
And then I go back. Yeah. And then I was like going back up there. Cause I'm like, liquid courage. And the bouncers had already got him. And I'm just like in his face. I'm like, that's right. And I was just like yelling at him. And as they were bringing him out and it was just totally crowded and everything. And I'm big idiot. So the next day I go there. The bouncers were like, we didn't know that was you, dude. If we knew that was you, we would have taken him to the bathroom and like taken care of him.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I am so glad you didn't know it was me because that guy didn't deserve it. I was the idiot. I mean, yeah, you know, he shouldn't have cold cocked me at the top of the stairs. But at the same time, I could have avoided that.
Yeah, right.
I wasn't the idiot. Then I would, and it's good to get your jaw. It's good to get knocked out and someone punch you in the jaw sometimes because it readjusts your thinking and you go, wow, what a bad idea that was. Yeah. And I'm lucky it was just a punch.
Mike Tyson says that everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah, I like that. Dude, have you heard about this Mike Tyson? Was it Jake Paul, is that his name? The fight coming
up? I heard that he's going to do that. Yeah, I don't know too many of the details, but I remember getting the bullet points. Yeah.
And it's going to be a Netflix fight. And I think it's the first fight that's going to be on. I'm scared for Jake Paul, man, because.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, and he's like even half his age. And it's just like, dude.
I forget who the last fight that he did. I'm forgetting who it was, but they showed that footage of Tyson just hitting the punching bag, you know, however old that he is now. And it was,
yeah,
no, thank you.
No, it's like, I mean, a younger guy might be able to get around and do stuff, but it's just, if he doesn't block one punch, he's out.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's,
I remember, seeing a video of Rogan explaining when he changed studios that he had, a longer, table. And he said, the reason I needed this longer table, and he was like, you know, don't get me wrong, like, I'm friends with Mike Tyson, but the first time that he interviewed him in person and there was this short table, he was just like, the energy that emanated off of this man, just when you're talking to him in a positive way, it was frightening him in a way that, like, he needed more space to not be distracted when he did the next studio. I was like, I get it. Yeah, for sure.
And I've heard interviews with Tyson where he even he talks about that, where he even like stopped going to the gym because if he's boxing, he's there to kill. And
Right.
he
Yeah.
doesn't like to be in that state of mind. Now he's back in that state of mind, but it's just, but for someone, you know, and I mean, you know, I fighting is like such a hard, you know, I enjoy watching the younger people do their stuff and then get out, you know, like get out of fighting. But for someone like Mike Tyson, who's just like the
Yeah.
guy's 60 or whatever, and it's just like he's a beast, and what a kind of sad, lonely place to be. If you have that much violence in you, it's a thing. But you know, I really liked what he did. I remember when he bit the ear, and it's
Yeah,
just
Evander
like, and
Holyfield.
yeah, and it was just like, oh man, dude, you're off the rails. Don't do that. And it was kind of like dirt on Tyson at the time. And then all of a sudden, he's in The Hangover. He's doing little comedies here and there. And they were like, oh, cute Mr. Tyson. She's like, no, that dude will kill you. So it's I mean, those are the only two sports I follow is UFC and baseball. If I followed any more, I would, you know, not write. So.
Just thinking about when you were saying how you were a Jehovah's Witness when the gang a member stopped you. Like, you tell me that I have Mormons in this book. Like, can you tell me that there was like kind of like you guys would beef? Like, you guys would be knocking on doors and the Mormons would be knocking on doors. Like, what was
So we would
did
have switchblades. No, I'm kidding. No, there was, you know, there was really not a lot of crossover because the way we did door to door was a very territory way. So we were covering, what we did. See, the Mormons got off. I wish my parents became Mormons instead of Jehovah's Witnesses because when you're a Jehovah's Witness, you're missionary through life. You don't do the 2-year missionary thing and then get set up in a job and go to college. When you're a Jehovah's Witness, you're knocking on doors constantly. You can't go to college and you become a window washer or a janitor and you live a poor lifestyle. So the way the Jehovah's Witnesses do it is you preach in your territory where you're at. So you have little boundaries and they just have all the records of every single time you knock on a door. Whereas the missionaries of Mormons, they kind of go, hey, the Holy Spirit led us to you. So they get to kind of knock on less doors and they get to go out, they get to leave their city and move and go to another city to be a mission on a mission. So the stakes for them are much lower because they're not seeing the cheerleaders in high school when they're going to the door at, you know, and having puberty time and just going, oh, oh my God, they're gonna kill me on Monday. So
They
it's
also, if there are certain types, not as many, but they get, they're born in the compounds down in Mexico. They get like a million wives too when they grow up.
Yeah, which just sounds like the worst idea.
I really,
I'm in a relationship. I'm like, how does anyone deal with
right.
two? And I'm sure they're saying the same thing to me. They're like, I can't deal with two dudes like that. So it's just, but that's the lovely yin and yang of relationships. So.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, I'm an atheist, and part of the the trajectory of the character in this book is I'm much less of a insufferable, annoying atheist than I used to be. I don't really feel like my opinions have changed, but I've been a lot more open just to kind of, you get utility out of it. I completely understand if some people get utility out of it, and especially if they would, invite me over to their house. I'm going to keep my opinions to myself. But
Yeah.
I read a lot of Mormon books for this story. The villains are, are extremist polygamous Mormons, which exist but definitely don't represent the majority. Obviously don't represent the majority even in a little bit, but
Right.
everything that happens in the book, it's kind of an amalgam of a lot of different things at different times, but everything that happens in the book pretty much did actually happen. And the thing that I really wanted to convey when just sort of really looking into the life of Joseph Smith, the guy that founded it was just like, even if I disagree with somebody, I have just so much respect for somebody with just balls, and just the balls that this dude had in his life to come up with this thing and have it be so just outrageous and outlandish that there was really just no chance. It just had to work. It was just, went so far beyond, and that he was so charismatic that there's just this admiration. Like when one of the South Park guys won for the Book of Mormon, you know, he thanked his co-writer Joseph Smith. You know, like he was a fascinating guy, like a really, really fascinating guy, and more people should know his life story.
And I think the mid 1800s are fascinating era, because that was a very like esoteric era. That's when the Jehovah's Witnesses came around. That's when the Seventh Day Adventists, we got the Mormons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you look deeper, I'm sure there's even more.
It was burned out district where Joseph Smith lived. It was everybody was coming up with their own religion, but you know, his was the one that's still around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, we were yapping about Joseph Smith, 1850s. I had a thought, you know, did you see the look of my eye? I was just like, oh, and you know that,
he probably got caught cheating, and the doctrine of polygamy was, God told me I'm supposed to have multiple. That's almost certainly what happened, that, you know, you have a thriving religion in 2024, and a big element of why it succeeded was because they had way more kids than the other religion. And one of the reasons they had so many more kids was because it would be one man and many, many wives, and the wives all had kids. And the reason that that happened was because this dude got caught cheating and factored it into the religion successfully.
Pure genius, by the way.
Yeah, you just have to admire the gigantic, you know, bowling balls this dude had between his legs as he was walking around in the 1820s and 1830s.
Yeah. I just remembered my thought, because with the South Park guys, what I love about them, because they hit Mormons a lot, even in the South Park episodes, mm-hmm. When I've seen them interviewed, and they're like, we really like the Mormons, like they're so nice,
like yeah, for sure.
And so that's what's great about satire is, yeah, you can satire someone or something, but you kind of got to do it with love, and then it works.
I
think even Book of Mormon, which I still need to see, it one of these days. But with Book of Mormon, it works because it's almost like, yeah, we're making fun of it, but it's also kind of a love letter at the same time. And when you do that little like, hey, this happened, you know, it's kind of crazy, but guess what? Life is crazy. It's and then it kind of comes together into a very human experience. And people can like laugh at it, but they laugh at it because it's very well developed characters at the same time. And there's a lot of thought put into all of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's quite a few good Mormon characters in this book. And it was kind of meant to represent a lot of some of the ex-Mormons that I spoke to, who kind of knew I was focusing on the really extreme minority. And I told them that was what the book was going to be about. And they were very nice about like, oh yeah, yeah, that sounds like a good book. Yeah. It's just, they're very nice people. I got really fascinated with, there was a crime. It would have been before the pandemic. I think it would have been maybe 2019, where, in Northern Mexico, there's a lot of, polygamous Mormon compounds in Northern Mexico. You know, mm-hmm. Mitt Romney's dad, they thought that he would have run for president, but you have to be born here, and he was born on one of those compounds, so he was not allowed to run for president. These are, you know, Caucasian English-speaking Mexican citizens who in some cases are so skilled in their paramilitary capabilities that they fight off the cartels down there. But in some cases they seem to have arrangements with the cartels. But there was an example of a convoy of Mormons that were going from one compound to another, and they were all massacred. And there are all these theories. No one really knows exactly what happens. Like maybe the cartel in the region thought that, maybe they found out since then. At the time, they didn't know what had happened, but you know, maybe they thought that there was another cartel. But I just started reading about these people that are only born inside the walls of these compounds, and just like how tough you have to be, and how much your faith that I find personally irrational, because it's all based on this, you know, convicted con man, Joseph Smith, but they believe it and they do things that I wouldn't have the courage to do. It was such a fascinating thing. I really, and how much thinking about how much these people can cite verses to say that the average American Mormon is kind of a fraud. And I think that from the perspective of what the guys who founded the religion would say, those Mormons down in Mexico would be right.
Right, because they were part of the original concept, except legal things came in.
Yeah, like in the I think it was the third president of the church that said that they weren't going to be polygamists anymore, and it was very clearly a politically pragmatic decision to just try to keep the church alive. It had no basis other than that, and that's what these polygamists say. And I don't think that they should be doing what they're doing, but from the point of view of their religion, they're obviously the ones that are correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the same thing like with the Jehovah's Witnesses. It depends on if legal things happen, all of a sudden they get new light from God. Yeah. And so it's just like, oh, to stay in the legal, you know, in the legal right, then all of a sudden it's just, oh, wait. We got this new light, blank, blank, blank. And it's like, oh, it's how interesting how it lines up with what you got sued for 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, you're close to the Scientologists over there where you live. It's like, I forget where
I had breakfast over there the other day.
Yeah. I still haven't gone. You were telling me about the cafe. I definitely want to experience that. There's a cult in the book called the Church of the Beyond, which is a, you know, wink, wink, like, who am I talking about there? You know?
Yeah.
I forget where they keep it, but a lot of the Sea Org in Scientology, they wear a cross, and that came about because the church was fighting for tax exempt status, and they needed to make a series of cases for were no different than the other religions that have tax exempt status. You can see that we wear this cross in the same way that you might see like a Catholic or a Protestant wearing a cross. And that's all about that particular battle that they went through, the Church of Scientology, which went to war with the IRS and beat the IRS.
And beat the IRS because they are very good at threatening and like, because I remember the time, it was lawsuits and it was also surveillance. They would surveil the IRS's families. They're like, you know, and I look at Tom Cruise and I'm like, you're in the middle of this? Oh my God, I hate you. And then I go to a Mission Impossible film and I'm like, that was one of the greatest films of all time.
Yeah, of course. It's like, I have sort of a vague plan to write something. There's a character in my story, a hotshot actor named Bud Skylark, that's kind of supposed to be Tom Cruise. And I am both completely sympathetic with the criticisms that people make about how he shouldn't be involved with this insidious cult. But at the same time, he's the man. He's Tom. He's just the man. Like, I have so much admiration for him. And I think that I want to believe that someday you're just going to hear that, you know, he's just going to say, I thought that this was something I needed forever, but I don't need it anymore. And he's going to leave the Church of Scientology. And he's just going to be like, I did this to prove that I can literally do anything. And then
I mean, he's like saving Hollywood right now.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
He alone, if it wasn't for him, Hollywood would be going, okay, everyone needs to learn Mandarin now because we're only.
No, I mean, and I should amend what I said earlier, because it's like, it gets so depressing post pandemic to go to movie theaters and see people take out their phones, even in the, you know, cinephile heavy LA. But when I went to the theater to see that last Top Gun movie, nobody was taking out their phone. People were clapping, people were cheering. It was just like, he's the man.
He's the man.
What can you say?
I know. It's like I try to just stick to my theaters, the Los Feliz 3, the Vista,
yeah,
the New Beverly, which just it limits my options. I hadn't been to a multiplex in a really long time, and I went and saw Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage, which I loved.
Yeah.
But I was at this IMAX whatever thing, and the seats shook during the and I'm like sitting there going, what the hell is this? People are so attention deficient that they need to have their seats shake during a big bass part of a I'm never going to that again. Just stick me back into a very small screening room at the Los Feliz 3 and I'll have my cup of coffee. Yeah. Watch a matinee, because that's the best part of life.
Yeah, for sure. It's a very like a mid-60s kind of a moment right now, where, you know, the old Hollywood system was collapsing and they didn't know what they were going to do. And, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider hadn't come out yet. And then it changed everything. They're just trying to figure out things to get people to go back to the theater. And, you know, I want to go back to the theater, but I want to go without people taking out their phones.
I would rather go to a theater where it was an adult theater and there was Pee Wee Herman sitting next to me in a trench coat. That's cool. Like, yeah, I'd be like, nice penis, dude. And you're like, oh, thank you. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, man. Just blew by.
There's a wonderful world where all you desire and everything you've longed for is at your fingertips. Where the bittersweet taste of life is at your lips. Where aisles and aisles of dreams await you and the cool promise of ecstasy fills the air. At the end of each working day, she's waiting there. I'm in love with the queen of the supermarket. As the evening sky turns blue, a dream awaits in aisle number two. With my shopping cart, I move through the heart of a sea of so blissfully unaware that they're in the presence of something wonderful and rare. The way she moves behind the counter, beneath her white apron, her secrets remain hers. As she bags the groceries, her eyes so bored and sure she's unobserved.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR-LP, 92.9 FM, Los Gatos and beyond.